Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls' weekly two-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We're seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 45, section 4. It's our arc, our local system of inhabited worlds. When I am afraid, I put my trust in you, in God, whose word I praise, in God I trust and am not afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? That's from Psalm 56. Always worth your time to spend some time in the Psalms. I'm Brad Garner, and we are so glad that you've joined us live or in our archive. We had a technical glitch last week that kept us off the virtual air, but we are back this evening, it appears. With us tonight, Dr. Chris Halverson, Andrea Barnes, and Dave Tucker. Dave is joining us tonight as an ongoing regular co-host. Now and on into 2024, Symmetry of Soul will be having rotating co-hosts for the three of us who, well, who aren't Dr. Chris. Every few episodes we'll rotate co-hosts, and it'll probably be this group here tonight for most of the rest of 2023. So won't you join us in our study? Please call up the text of the Urantia book by paper or electronic means and take a virtual seat with us as we seek new wineskins. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. Yeah, thanks for that little clarification for everyone, and greetings to you, Dave, as you officially step in here, and greetings to you, Andrea, and everyone who's joining us. Well, if everyone can remember where we were 2 weeks ago, we'll be stepping right back into that spot. We, as I mentioned at the end of the previous broadcast, we're going to be starting off with a very interesting fact about the organization and administration of the universe of universes as it comes down close to us and is actually overseen by us, one-time mortals. So this is a very, very interesting section about the 420 counselors. And we'll also get into what those material sons and daughters are about a little bit, and that'll continue into the next broadcast. So settle in, everyone, and hope you enjoy the show.
Yeah, looking forward to it. The 420 counselors were a number of one of the many things in the parade of things that were spooky to me as a child in the wake of the movie Ghostbusters. They're referenced famously in the book of Revelation, and they are clarified famously, not so famously, but truthfully, here in the Urantia book. So looking forward to getting to this. And good evening to you, Andrea. How's everything out your way?
Oh, everything out here is great. And I was just thinking, Brad, that maybe at some point people will say that about what the Urantia book has done to the 420 counselors. I don't think we'll see it in our lifetime, but at some point the whole world will know about the book and be amazed at that. So, yeah, I'm glad to be here tonight. Looking forward to it.
Yes, glad that you're here. And, yeah, the book is here for many, many centuries to come, and we'll be seeding the ground for further revelation to come in the future. But here we are now. A handful of generations into studying this thing that was dropped in our laps, trying to make synthesized sense of it all. And Dave, good evening to you, Dave. We've always enjoyed having you here on the show when you've dropped in as a sort of a pinch hitter, and we're just so excited to have you here as an ongoing co-host. And I think you're also going to help spin us back up. It seems like ages since we were last here talking.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to it. Had fun writing it and had some time being able to refine it too. So I'm very, very grateful for that. Also wanted to say thank you for this opportunity. And it's a tremendous gift to be able to study this intently, especially when I'm prone to have a bias that likes to not pay attention to details too often. So it's a real blessing for me, and it's a lesson every time I get a chance to do it too. So, but yeah, I want to say hello to each of the co-hosts as well. And kind of get into our review here. This was really fun. So the discussion began after the summary with the follow-up to the point something that Brad was pondering in the previous week's episode regarding the logical hierarchy order of things and beings. Brad brings up the point of how many readers question why wisdom comes after worship in the sequential order of the seven adjutant mind spirits. This is an initial step of not just blowing past that tension in our mind and facing it and upending our old perspectives. The very fact that we tend to question whether the spirit of worship should be above the spirit of wisdom is why the book is here. Our ungoverned zeal has a lot to do with why there is an emergency on our planet. And if you indeed desire revelation, you desire to come upon passages in the book that directly challenge you and will change you. And if you don't put yourself first, you'll be changed for the better if you have the courage to change. When we encounter those points of subjective contention, we need to have the courage to see through the annoyance of those differentials and take them on directly to upend our old wineskins. The more secular man becomes here in this growing endarkenment, the more disturbing almost everything in the revelation becomes to us. It's becoming such an extreme confrontation of preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices now. Even religious worldviews, of course, are challenged, but it's harder and harder to find an actual religious worldview on our planet. The revelators remind us that many of the world's religionists are unwitting actual secularists. And if we find some valid thread of truth, and we find that to be upheld in the revelation, there's a great challenge not to make that experience about yourself. It's very easy to say something like, wow, I really did that there. Check me out. But we naturally want to have some aspect of our experience orbiting about ourself. And the challenge is to seek first the kingdom of heaven, the recognition of the real nucleus about which everything orbits. It's natural to look for confirmation of your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices. Once we get into the kingdom, though, we're expected to get moving just as soon as we can. We need all things in balanced proportions to maintain symmetry. When studying the revelation, even in the immediacy of what could get you excited and potentially overexcited to where you lose that symmetry, there are humbling statements in the accompanying words that can easily be overlooked. The challenge is to see all those words as they're written and to avoid the temptation from your unity eye to just fuzz out all those pesky details that have nothing to do with my feelings, especially when we might need to be grounded a little bit more solidly because you've come upon words that began to propel you upwards. Symmetry of soul, keep your balance and keep your proportion. And when you keep your eyes on all the words, you'll notice they've constructed the revelation masterly and help us in that regard. The revelators directly take on the philosophic issues of all doctrines in the revelation. They wrote this book for genuine religionists who are ready to take the journey upwards towards being born again and achieved religiosity of philosophical attainment. True religionists of philosophic attainment must go through those philosophical issues. Ruthie asked for some clarification on what the revelators mean when they use words as spirit or spiritualize. Spiritualize is used when your sense of self is over-spiritualizing something. For instance, God is spirit and God is good, but all things taken to extreme become bad. Technically, you're speaking about someone being spiritual in a personal context. You're declaring that person isn't merely in the position in possession of a functioning mind, but in addition, to some degree, that person's mind is under personality management. You're declaring that the person uses their personality management to wield spirit upon their mind, to reframe it so that it functions in a different fashion than it functions normally. A spiritual person has modalities of mind activity that cannot be explained by their mere biologic framing of their mind. Spiritual people have changed that framing so that now that mind functions differently than it would naturally. What it means to be a spiritual human is to be artificial, unnatural. a person that exhibits a mind that's under personality management, not just moving through life causally as its biologic temperament would dictate. Once you begin to manage your mind and say to yourself that you're not going to just let it function as my God-given biology would have it function, I'm going to change its functioning, the immediate challenge is to figure out lots of individual facts. What's right? What's wrong? Good, bad, truth, error. An attempt to find the proper balance and proportion to everything. We begin to have the self or the start of a self-awareness on the third level of meaning, the level of self-regard. As the master pointed out to us, he finds us basically functioning on the first two levels of meaning, the level of the levels of the flesh and the level of the feelings. Getting that vantage point onto the next level above that, onto the level of the mind, you can take regard of the basic natural modality of your mind down there on those lower levels. The next level up, the fourth level of meaning, now you have a spiritual vantage point. The first level on that spiritualized mind in the upper domain. And from that vantage point, you can literally look back on all the levels of yourself. Respect to look back. You can have true self-respect and the full sense of that self. You can look back upon and have a beginning objectivity about yourself. Foundationally, that's as far as you should take it, take that uplift of self. That fourth level is a balanced and proportionate amount of uplift. If you allow that sense of self to reach the fifth level of meaning, it's beginning to turn negative. Self-respect becomes self-esteem. From that fifth level, you could very easily sell yourself on how fancy you are when observing yourself on the first four levels. You could end up mistakenly giving some of that spiritualized mind on the fourth level an incorporation into just your biologic nature. You're overplaying yourself. We must recognize that when we see that from the vantage point, it's not there because you were born, and it's not part of you and what you naturally are. That's there by the grace of God alone. And a humble recognition of that fact is required of each of us. If you go on to the sixth level of meaning, now you willfully make that self-esteem fully negative as self-admiration, self-love. We use the word over-spiritualization versus using a term like false spiritualization, for instance, because we have to lift it up from the level of the flesh where it's very woe is me. We have no self-respect. We have to lift it up by allowing spiritual gravity to lift our sense of self up some, but we need to immediately take control of it from there, not allow it to continue up any further. To allow it to go any further would be to over-spiritualize the sense of self with misapplication of spirit. The sixth adjutant, the spirit of zeal, dawned in the collective in the middle of the 20th century, and there was an additional energization, of people's minds, and a false exaltation began to manifest. In a very cultural and collective way, you literally had these self-esteem movements began to form. Revelation tells us that self-esteem is a negative word. Why would we want to foster the corruption of mankind in a movement? The revelators give us the clues when they say things like the problematic self-esteem of the Apostle John. They don't tell us, wouldn't it be great if John only had the self-esteem movement to help him out? Again, seeing all the words as they are and not allowing ourselves to gloss over them is a skill we must develop if we sincerely seek truth and seek to have revelation reveal itself to us each time we sit to study the Urantia book. The word ego is not a negative word. It literally means self-aware. You want to be self-aware self. If you want to be a human, animals are not self-aware. Unfortunately, the word ego has become a synonym with the word egotism. Egotism is a negative word because it falsely exalts the self, misapplying spirit beyond a balanced proportion. Ego is good in and of itself because it allows us to pull ourselves out of the mud and see ourselves as children of God. But all things taken to an extreme become bad. Adding the T in egotism indicates that you've taken a good thing to an extreme, and now it's bad. As the master tells us, you have to first consciously realityize your own child of godness to be born again. After that initiation, that happens by grace alone for us, then we must take control of the situation and I don't mean a reality TV show character from New Jersey. After secure entrance into the kingdom, we're expected to properly manage our own ascension so that it's creative rather than destructive. We must courageously take that leap of faith and cross that threshold by stepping into the domain of personal responsibility and manage yourself properly. True liberty is predicated on personal responsibility and self-control. We picked up reading on paper 45, section 2, paragraph 1, and the discussion picked up in the local universe. We have three basic levels of cosmological structure to that universe, to the local universe. The local universe level at the bottom, the constellation level in the middle, and the local universe headquarters level at the top. The three branches of government in local universe have seats that are hierarchically arranged. There is executive, legislative, and judicial throughout, but each of those branches of local universe government has a seat in this hierarchical three-level system. The executive branch is seated at the local system level. The legislative branch is seated at the constellation level, and the judicial branch is seated at the local universe headquarters level. When we start talking about local systems, that's the immediacy of the administration that we're talking about. The primary seat is the executive branch, not legislative or judicial. Also, we have this name for our local system, Satania. Why is it fundamentally called Satania? When you're reading the Revelation, you need to think not so much in theological terms, but more in a philosophical terms, and all the sciences within the philosophical framing. One of those sciences is etymology, the logic of words being used. Etymology focuses on the literalness of the word. So we have this word Satan, which the Revelators use, that's coming from Hebrew roots. The word Satan in Hebrew translates as adversary. If you capitalize it, it becomes the adversary with a capital A. The general Hebrew verb that they're playing with means to be adverse. The name of our local system is based upon that. The literalness of the word Satania is the nation of adversity. Our local system, out of the local systems like nations, is that nation of adversity, because this rebellion was the most widespread in all of our local universe. The verse part of the word adverse means turn. A turning to the opposite is a sense of it. This is further fleshed out in notes about etymology in the Library of Perfecting Horizon Institutes, and can be found there as well. The Lucifer Rebellion upended itself. It seductively led astray and turned the whole order to the opposite of a logical recognition and engagement with both deity and reality. This is the philosophical argument, and they use these words because they want us to engage this text philosophically. Fundamentally, this text is for religionists who desire to become religionists of philosophic attainment. They don't want us to react with the typical simplistic theological knee-jerk religious reactions to the word like that comes natural for all of us. We've all been exposed to so much of this unbridled liberty here, and we must get back between the lines again. The whole tension of you're not the boss of me, well, there is a boss of us. And that boss is the system sovereign. Ever since the U.S. Constitution was drafted, there's been a tension of people who say we had some difficulties there in that particular area, and I think we should change the technique. Well, the Revelators are telling us, no. We need to trust the technique that's been wisely constructed. We don't need to start by getting the eraser out and rewriting things, and we just need to be able to gracefully and humbly allow it to play forward. Evolutional, not revolutional. That tension to think or say, you're not the boss of me, is a tendency to revolution in the face of difficulty, as opposed to trusting in the evolutionary process in a wisely conceived frame. We need to let it play out. When we go on high, we're talking about literally perfect beings being in the construct of things. For example, the ancients of days don't need their technique of government amended based upon any further experience, ever. And it trickles all the way down to us and our vast imperfections. This reviewer sincerely attempts to summarize with the aim of highlighting in my own way the truth that I recognize in the show, that I've been gifted with the opportunity to review. So with that said, and in full cooperative subordination to my unity conscious bias that I have, I've decided to forego the details of how this reviewer has come to this conclusion and just share the truth of it. Lanaforge is rad. Be sure to listen to the archives for individual details of how I formed that conclusion. And for your own recognition of truth, like I've been given here today by the grace of the Holy Spirit. And that concludes our story.
Oh, I love it.
Gnarly,
yeah,
dude.
Terrific. Gnarly.
Lovely. Thank you.
Rad, not radical in the political sense. And he's talking
right,
about
right. Yes, yes.
Not a political
yes,
radical. Thank the heavens for that. We already had one of those systems, Sovereign. Not a good idea.
Like an 80s BMX movie kind of rad, you know? Like
totally tubular, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, thank
but,
you, Dave.
But just quick little side note there. The very fact that we've taken the word radical and formed that, that rad term, it shows how we have a tendency to want radical to be a positive word and not a negative one.
Oh, that's true, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, we also live in very intensifying times. Yeah. Dave, that was fantastic. I know that you put a lot of effort into that, and it covers a lot of ground. And what I really appreciate is how shining through that, I think we can see glimmers of your own individual personal journey through all of this. I'm hearing a lot of notes about, self-respect, not self-esteem. And I don't think you would be alone here in people who have tried on self-esteem movements. I'm not saying that you did, but it sounds like you might have, it's very popular. And just getting all that cleared up and thinking in a more logical frame about a healthy respect for our ego without exalting it up to the levels of being a god, essentially. So I appreciated how you put words to that.
Thank you, Brad. My favorite part is right what you were talking about as well, like the part where Chris was saying on the previous show that we need a certain amount of this to pull ourselves out of the mud, because there are a lot of people that are just deep in the mud. They don't have an ego. They don't have a genuine self-respect for themselves. And that's a necessary point to recognize, but the fact that we have to be able to take grasp of it, control of it, and say, okay, I'm going to manage this now. I'm going to make sure throughout my day, by everything I encounter, I'm going to measure what I know to be so against what I'm doing. I think that's where I've recognized, wow, okay, this is a real, okay, I'm not on autopilot here. This matters. This is playing for keeps, this is really important. And I'm really grateful to kind of have some of these things illuminated for me, because if I hadn't have recognized that or heard that, or we wouldn't be discussing that, I wouldn't recognize how important my role is in this. My role is to be on guard. What am I allowing in and about myself? What am I doing? How is this revelation reforming the way I look at everything?
Dave, I have had the almost identical experience these past couple of weeks with these same thoughts, which is pretty typical of the two of us. We tend to really think a lot alike, and I can't tell you how much that was could have come out of my mouth.
Yeah, just a quick little reinforcement of the technical issue in play there about keeping a watch upon your soul. Remember that it's much easier to forsake the kingdom than it is to get into it. You're trying to make that initial faith grasped a real faith grasp of being born again and entering the kingdom. I mean, you're doing that, you know, with almost no relationship to spiritualized mind at all. You're trying to bootstrap yourself up, you know, out of the mud, as it were, of your material mind. That's, you know, wanting to, you know, suck you back down like you're, you know, your hip waders, you know, deep in the mud. But once you enter the kingdom, now you have direct access to that spiritualized mind. So it's much easier to forsake the kingdom. You have all of the just innately dynamic quality of mind at your fingertips. So you can propel yourself out with great energy, you know, relative to, you know, how you struggled upward to get within.
It's pretty counterintuitive. Well, I think some people, you know, there's a church that I often mention that we attend, or not full members at, and I think that the pastors at this church must know this on some level, because they kind of repeat a lot of the same messages every week, and they very much try to give people a lot of opportunities to have activities with the church, to be in small study groups together, to meditate day and night on the law of the divine law. It's even in the best of times you can drift out of the kingdom, drift back to worldly concerns, but you know, doubly or quintuply so these days of late. But it sure isn't the most intuitive thing for some people. Some people say, you know, once saved, always saved, and other such very wishfully simplistic theologic notions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it, one of the reasons why the Christian church struggles with this issue theologically, you know, as we've studied part four in various arcs on this broadcast, we've you know, come to more recognize that you know, Jesus had to back off of his initial, you know, really commission as a bestowal son, you know, but definitely even his earthly planning, you know, to seek out people who had been born again and foster them upward, right, to be a religious uplifter of those beginning religionists. Yeah, but he, you know, discovered that what he needed to do is try to focus on step one of actually getting people across the threshold of a spiritual birth. And so when you take the little tidbits of remembering of what Jesus said and did amongst the apostles and the disciples, and you put them forward into the Christian tradition and a theology develops, it's not very aware of the whole issue of, you know, the religionist of philosophic attainment that eventually achieves being born again. And so, you know, the reality is, in general, a Christian church, if it still is religiously motivated instead of, you know, socially motivated, you know, is trying to foster people across the threshold, trying to get them to their spiritual birth. You know, and honestly, the church theologically doesn't really know what to do with someone once they're born.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah. Once they're born again. And so, you know, that's why it's important to, you know, to note that, you know, it isn't just Chris pointing out, you know, what I just said about how it's much easier to throw yourself out of the kingdom than to get in there in the first place. And that's why Jesus said, once you enter the kingdom, you face a fear test, a severe test, because it's so much, just energetically, mind energy, energetically, so much easier to propel yourself out of the kingdom than it was to get in there in the first place.
Is this why you mentioned before how may not be a good idea to tell other people about the Urantia book, because then they're responsible for the knowledge. And is that kind of what you're talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things sort of, you know, that we often talk about that are troubling or challenging. See, that have to do with this different, this whole different set of circumstances that you face once you're in the kingdom. I mean, a parallel thing, we're talking about getting to the mansion worlds here as we're reading about the local system, and you know, indirectly we're kind of thinking about ourselves getting to the mansion worlds. You know, that parallel issue of, you know, it's much easier to go astray when you have Maranja mind, you know, on the mansion worlds than here when you have this very inertia-laden adjutant mind. It's just the exact same physics. Right? The more spiritualized the mind gets, the less innate internal resistance it has. The more it's a it's a free flowing mind, and it can quickly get away from you because of that.
Sounds like we're gonna need a lot of humility.
Right, you ever need humility, and you need to develop the skill to manage. You know, I mean, a little kid can handle a horse that's just waddling along, right? But can that little kid handle the horse if it starts running at a full gallop?
Right.
I see that's what we're talking about. You know, can the little child of God handle a mind that starts to run at a full gallop?
Is that horse called Zeal?
The energy of Zeal is just a foretaste of how animated, you know, the mind is in the upper domain. All these things, you know, need to be considered together. The Christian Church, you know, kind of get to, you know, just touch back on that. I mean, theologically, they may not have a lot of assistance for someone who's been born again to continue their development, you know, to philosophically advance, you know, once they enter the kingdom. But, you know, their emphasis on the pitfalls, right, you know, especially since they still have such a strong dual spiritism, you know, mentality or theology, I mean, it will tend to, not foster growth, subsequent being born again, but also to not foster problems, because the person gets so weighted down, you know, with concern, you know, that their progress is slow enough that they can probably manage it. But, you know, you start giving them more revelation about liberty, and things get problematic, right? The more you talk about the love of God, the more you become mostly unwittingly aware of the liberty part of your upper domain. Right, that liberty of that upper domain that kind of talking about how smoothly and, you know, effortlessly it can flow is right there with the love part. You know, and so you focus them on the love, but they don't recognize how problematic liberty is that's right there with that love consciousness. And immediately they go racing off into false love, and false liberty.
Well, the more we've talked about this over the years here, the easier it's for me to understand why the fifth epical revelation is here. It is one of our popular themes. We bring it up often. But, you know, you throw off the ecclesiastical totalitarian bondage of the Middle Ages and, frankly, all 990,000 years that came before of just abject fear governing your every waking moment. And now you're in this era where you've been shown that there's ability to have more freedom, and there are societies that are more ordered around freedom of the individual, and an entire, you know, the Western world is tries to array itself that way. But yeah, off you go into false liberty. I'm basically reciting paper 195. Along comes a new form of totalitarianism to try to clamp you back down, put you under control, but it's a secular force. It's not even a religious force. And so you're in quite a pickle. I understand why we needed additional revelation now. It's this sheltered bay problem. You can't put the genie back in the bottle, the toothpaste back in the tube. We're not in the Middle Ages anymore. We're not in ancient times anymore. We have seen a larger view of the universe, but we don't know how to comport ourselves within that without more revelation.
Much reflective ability to recognize that if you stimulate an individual to be less fearful, but don't at the same time stimulate them to be more wise, you know, how problematic is a fearless, naive person?
It's a train wreck. It's a total
right.
train wreck.
It's a giant train wreck. Right? Yep. And that's why the revelation is here. We have that train wreck. People don't understand, what kind of fire they're playing with. When they, go waltzing into a more spiritualized modality of mind, for all the various reasons, internally and externally, that this could be problematic.
Right.
So you can definitely start to, like you're saying, Brad, more immediately understand why such a philosophic text is before us for us to study. That unwise mind will destroy civilization, more and more individual by individual, it destroys souls.
Right, eternal states.
How did the souls get destroyed?
Yeah.
How did the souls get destroyed?
How did people, that were born again and were religionists become unwitting actual secularists, which means they're soul-destroying individuals? That's the thing. There's the natural secular nature of our animal origin material mind. Okay, but that's not secularism. You have to spiritualize. You have to get into the kingdom to some degree to sort of fully then take that spiritualized mind and turn it around 180 degrees from creativity to destructivity.
Yeah,
and
most
that's what
people
secularism
don't even...
is referring to. Someone who is, is fundamentally using their spiritualized, their ability to be spiritual, to definitively put their mind under personality management, but they're directing it to a godless end, towards godless ideals.
Yeah.
It's not survival value.
That destroys the soul. When we talk about error is self-confusing, evil is self-disrupting, sin is self-destroying. Okay, what self are we talking about there? The whatever mortal animal origin self that doesn't survive death at all anyway, and so, isn't it like innately self-destroying because it's mortal? It's like, no, see, they're talking about, your potentially immortal self. That
gaining
self
the world
is being
and
destroyed
losing your soul.
By sin.
Right.
And what is sin? It's a devotion to godless ideals.
But what if they've never really been, entertaining any thoughts of God?
Well, like I said at the beginning, we all start out innately, secular, minds that are, material, based, human-based, temporal-based, right? We're innately, up from the humus humans, and we're, temporally oriented. We're secular. And that's the way we are born. But if you take that beginning and start to choose it to be an ending, see, I can use my personality, my powers of choice, to see that material, human, temporal beginning as an ending and everything in between, to make it a complete lifestyle solution, to make it my origin, history, and destiny. And if I do that, I'm a secularist. I'm a humanist. And I have no survival value, and you are destroying the potential survival value that was given to you at roughly age 6. I mean, not only will you not be adding to that, but you begin to eat away at what you were given. Because your soul, you know, when the adjuster made your soul, your embryonic soul, there was some, you know, cosmic meaning and value in that soul. Yeah, the matrix of that soul was framed relative to divine ideals. If you choose to reframe it relative to godless ideals, then that soul no longer holds any cosmic meaning or value. It's dead.
Well,
yeah,
these are certainly things to...
What if you don't know what you're doing?
Again, it's... I mean, you know, as long as, you know, there's a genuine, just immature, you know, budding child nature, okay, that's not damning. These things of evil, sin, and iniquity are spiritual things. Right? There has to be, personality management for those terms to even have any applicability. Right? You have to be, spiritually managing your mind away from its God-given good beginning. You know, you have to be redirecting the functioning of your mind away from God and ultimately towards yourself.
Well, that's really the key, is getting over yourself. And, and just to try to balance out the conversation, that Dave used that word a lot in his review. God is not asking anything of you that you aren't capable of doing. If you'll just use your will in a positive modality, you have the tools to do this here. This is not an impossible climb. It can sometimes feel that way if we talk about the darkness and the endarkenment and the troubled times. But you can still be a faith son of God now, just as well as in any other time. But you do have to be sincere and wholehearted in that.
So again, just Brad is saying there. I mean, the initial budding religionist who's very fearful, they're going to most likely be quite secure. That fear chastens them, right? That fear of the Lord is not only the beginning of wisdom, it is stimulus for them having some beginning wisdom.
Yeah.
Right? And so they have a little bit of wisdom, right, effectively because of that fear. They're not going to be moving very fast, right? But they're secure in that snail's pace. But if you take someone who is, is animated by the idea of God and love and you convince them to not have any, fearful self-constraint, well, then what's going to constrain them? And so, that's when we get into the audience for the fifth epical revelation. If you don't have some self-governing ability, once fear doesn't just govern you, right? If you don't have some self-governing ability above what fear does naturally to your mind, and keeping it in between the lines, you will stray outside the lines.
It's something for us to think about as we all try to make sense of this revelation. Certainly a lot of people have seen the liberty that it speaks of, but have not felt fearful or suitably chastened or restrained with the law that it also mentions in balanced, proportionate measure. We do have a caller. I want to watch the clock here, make sure that we can get to our caller. But first of all, anything else on that? Or this is a fruitful discussion.
Yeah, we can leave that there. Let's take the caller, and I'll have another comment afterwards about another issue.
Oh, okay. Well, here we go. 602, you're on the air.
Hello. This is Ruthie.
Oh, hello, Ruthie.
I just thought I'd chime in since I was there a couple weeks ago, and I actually just wanted to maybe clarify or anyway bring up the you know, rewinding about 30 minutes ago. It was mentioned I had a couple weeks ago brought up the terms spirit and spirituality, and I, for me, that my point of bringing that up was really to clarify what I think I understand now, and if that's not correct, my understanding is how the word spiritualized was used. It was maybe a little more playfully, not exactly how the Urantia book uses that term. That's what I was just trying to clarify, that, you know, to over-spiritualize is sort of a newly coined phrase, but spirit itself is I'm not, I question using the words that way, that you truly are ever over-spiritualizing. It's more of a self-attitude that was being spoken of.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, one of the problems that, you know, that you're facing when you talk about spiritualizing your mind is this liberty issue. You know, that that the constraints are not built innately into the spiritualization. And so when we talk about spiritualization, we could be focusing on various aspects, you know, just the fact of it, you know, or we could be talking about the positive consequences of that spiritualization or the negative consequences of that spiritualization. And so the word spiritual or spiritualized, it could have different senses depending upon the context of our conversation. It's kind of a shorthand for a number of things, just factual or, like I'm saying, you know, actually good or bad. You know, that dimensionality, if you will, of the word is one of the reasons why one has to, you know, think very precisely and find out the true sense of its usage in a particular setting. You know, or if you're listening to me toss out the word, you got to figure out, well, what's Chris referring to here? Definitely if I'm focusing, say, on the destructivity aspect of spiritualization, that doesn't mean there isn't a creative, you know, potential of spiritualization. And not to mention, you know, aside from those directing, you know, sort of considerations, just the fact of spiritualizing, you know, giving the mind this greater fluidity, you know, less viscosity. You know, it can flow more smoothly. I mean, that's why, you know, it can flow so smoothly that without hardly any processing at all, something can just be self-evident. Whereas our material mind, in order to get to some decent conclusion, we've got to plod along through a very viscous, you know, stiff mind. You know, and eventually you come up with, oh, therefore that means, whereas with that much more, you know, fluid, less viscous mind, spiritualized mind, it just almost in an instant, a whole bunch of processes eventuated into just a moment's thought. See, so spiritual is this very diverse term, right? But it's all fundamentally, like Dave was saying in the review, indicating that you are beginning to make your mind an art form, artificial, You are taking control of it, modifying it from what it is and how it functions as a mere material mind.
There seem to be multiple meanings in play in all these words, so
yeah.
It can take a while to try to make
yeah.
sense of this, because we don't have time to spend an hour on this, but we also
yeah.
have God is spirit. We've been to this well before. It's like, well, that sounds like
yeah.
innate divinity. That word, those, that letter, that
yeah.
word symbol sounds pretty good.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, I even mentioned that 2 weeks ago when Ruthie brought this up. We were talking about it. You know, I haven't even mentioned. Then there's just forgetting about beings and their minds, and just there's this stuff, there's this substance called spirit. and you could be using the word spiritual when you're saying, when you need an adjective that's referring to the properties of that stuff.
Hmm.
Right, like you're talking about, for Brad here, who's a geologist, if you're talking about the hardness of a rock.
Right.
Hmm.
Quantity
what is it
and
on
quality
the hardness
of
scale?
The stuff. Sure.
What are the properties of this stuff? So, there's a lot of places in the book that, we're talking about spirit that has nothing to do with beings at all. Bottom line, the fundamental thing that you mean when you say God is spirit is you want to think of him as not a being with a physical energy body, but a being with a spirit energy body. Even though that's but in terms of how he relates to you as a reality object, he's actually deity stuff, okay, outside of reality. But we do the same thing when we talk about a thought adjuster, which is fundamentally a fragment of deity stuff. It's not physical energy, mindal energy, or spiritual energy, right? It's literally deity stuff is fragmented. But in terms of how it engages reality relative to us, initially, it's as if it is a spirit fragment. And so you can say the thought adjuster is spirit, like you can say God is.
Well, yeah, I think we'll have to chew on this stuff some more.
No pun intended.
But think about how important this is.
So.
Jesus says, God is your spiritual father. Okay, and, you've got some arbitrary definition or, connotations, thoughts about the word spiritual. What is he telling you, right? When he says God is your spiritual father, because he's the father of your potential to have personality management. He gave you a personality. He's your, he's the father of that. He's the author of that.
Mm-hmm.
He's the bestower of that. He's your spiritual father.
Ruthie, did you have another comment there? I heard you.
Well, it sounds like the show needs to go on, but I I would just part with, I'll be honest, I question some of the ways that word has been used here, and what's coming to mind is spirituality being the indicator of nearness to God. And I mean, yes, understanding there can be a substance, there can be all these other avenues. It seems problematic to be, I don't know. I'll leave it at that. I think it's helpful to clarify what we're meaning when we use the term, certainly.
Yes,
yeah,
it is.
It was helpful for me too in the review, but Ruthie, you called it like perfect time. I didn't know you were going to call, but I was literally going to say something before we started in tonight's reading, and since you're on the call, it'd be great to say it now. I wanted to just say thank you for your contributions to the show, because you've given all of the readerships or listenership a gift, including myself, just to witness you and Brad as husband and wife sharing, engaging, doing your best to help aid each other in understanding this revelation. It's truly a remarkable thing. And I know so many of us that are readers don't have a spouse that also shares in this hunger for truth and thirst for righteousness. And I think it's just a beautiful thing. I'm very grateful for your contributions, both you and Brad, and I very much look forward to any future engagements that you guys do. I really want to look at that talk you guys gave at the International Conference on Family. So I just wanted to voice that to you, and I'm glad you called in. It was just a wonderful opportunity to do so.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And apparently I'm not leaving, so I'll just call back again. Anyway, thanks for taking the call.
Yep. Thanks, Rosie. Yeah, I just, you know, one little quick thing, because you brought it up too there, Brad. You know, when Kermit was co-hosting, you know, we often, you know, commented about this very issue, this, you know, how our culture, if, you know, if it has taught us, you know, in this space where you think about God and such, you know, that culture has tended to equate spirituality and divinity. You know, and, you know, maybe not, you know, directly, but at least indirectly. You know, and so we often, you know, talked about how spirit is not innately divine. You know, that you want to think fundamentally, you have three quantities in reality: physical energy, mindal energy, spiritual energy. You know, three quantities. And you are using personality, those quantities, ultimately to a particular quality. Right? And that quality that you're going to purpose those quantities into is called divinity. Right? When the grand universe is settled in light and life, all physical energy, absolutely every single measure of it, all mindal energy, same way, all spiritual energy, all three energies will be completely divine. You'll not only have all of those quantities out there, but they will all be perfectly purposed to be deity-like.
Divinity.
To be reflections of the functioning of deity. They'll have this quality to their quantity, and that quality is deity-likeness, divinity. They will function together in a harmonious system as if they were the functioning of the singular deity itself. The line between a threefold reality stuff and a onefold deity stuff will be blurred, as it were, quality-wise.
Wow. Okay. That's quite a ways off for the grand universe, but in our own lives, that's what we strive for as well, to be perfect, even as God is perfect.
And think of that perfection, see, as a tri-unity. So you have three energies. Okay, but you're going to give them going to make them as if they were one quality-wise, a tri-unity. See, and that singular tri-unity quality, you know, matches up with the singular deity quality. Because deity just has one flavor of stuff, okay? Deity stuff. There aren't three energies like in reality. So that harmonization of the three to a tri-unity is making it so that it can be a one-to-one quality synchronization with the functioning of deity. Yeah, so it's just a matter of kind of you know, getting that recognition that spirit is fundamentally just this energy, and you've been given a personality to purpose it, to give it a quality. You know, you can, because you have free will, right? This, you know, the spiritual energy that you have any immediate access to, which is only that which can be directed upon your mind, but nonetheless, you have this sort of access to it, you know, you can choose to purpose it antithetical to the functioning of deity. Right? Instead of conformal.
Yeah. That's free will, right.
Right. And so if there's divinity, there's its opposite, right? When we're talking about personality management.
There has to be.
You know,
yeah.
You know, you can't conceive of the creative end of divinity without also conceiving of the destructive end of iniquity. Yeah, to take something to iniquity is to take it so that it no longer, in a triunity sense, has one iota of conformity with the functioning of deity. It's antithetical to deity. All right.
I think that helps. Go ahead, Chris. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to move on to the next quick comment, but finish your thought there.
Well, no, I just was saying that I think that helps give some shape. I feel like this is an ongoing conversation as we try to work through the meanings of these words. And these are eternal, timeless concepts, and yet some of us, raised his hand, are struggling to grasp the deeper truths at play here, not just the first Sunday after your baptism in a Christian church moment, but the deeper stuff. Chris, by all means, your other comments?
Yeah, okay. So a quick one. You know, etymology got mentioned in the review. And, let's just remind ourselves again of why Chris so annoyingly, so constantly brings up etymology. We are trying to study a revelation of truth. There is a logic to truth which can be expressed in words. You can't express truth in words, but there's a logic of truth that can be expressed in words. The word etymology literally means the logic of truth.
Really?
The root word in Greek there is truth.
Really? Wow.
If you're trying to find a revelation of truth, in this book, from this book, it's impossible to do it apart from the logic of truth, the etymology of the words.
Hmm.
Right? See, so us spending all that time on spiritual, this is the point. If you don't figure out the logic, right, of the truth of that word, you can never have access to the truth of the fifth epical revelation. All you can do is look at the words and recognize the logic of truth that's literally in those words, and then through that, the wholeness of that logical recognition, find the truth.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
Chris,
I feel like I've come a little ways with that, but it's pretty fuzzy, but it's getting a little bit more clarity around the edges. I feel like a blind man that's starting to see a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the tendency in modern society is to use the word spiritual humanistically instead of religiously. You literally have the expression, "I'm spiritual but not religious." So in other words, you're testifying that you refuse to use the word spiritual religiously. You want to use it self-servingly, humanistically.
Yeah. I'm going to just say a real short little thing. I don't think it's off track. I was listening to a TED Talk yesterday, and the guy was going on about how, you can use people of faith to get the job of social justice done because, they feel this inherent guilt. And he tried to make it this lofty, lovely chat, but at one point during the whole thing, he got really down in the weeds about how, you know, hey, it's you know, God sort of at the center of all this, but of course he couldn't say the word God, and he, all of a sudden he must have looked out in the audience, and he goes, now, don't worry, I'm not going to bring up God here, folks, don't worry. And I thought, good Lord, can you believe this? It was just appalling.
Yeah, he's got one foot in each side of the camp, and neither one of them wants him.
Exactly.
He didn't say his name, but when you so consciously, overtly say you're not going to mention God, who are you mentioning?
Yeah.
Lucifer.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, Chris, you bring up an interesting point really quickly about this same mode of thought. Like, when you're throughout the day, I listen to a lot of audiobooks, for instance, and I find myself hearing someone give an opinion about, like, how, you know, it's important to have self-love or something, and my first reaction is to go, you know, that scoffing kind of thing. And, like, I've been trying to recognize it and stop myself from doing that. I really don't want to scoff at anyone for anything anymore. But it's a natural response that just comes up automatically, almost like, you know, like a almost involuntarily. But when
you don't have to reject the person, but you obviously need to reject their thoughts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, that scornfulness, right, that is so damning. It's you know, maybe you're stimulated, you know, by the words, but you don't separate their words, their thoughts from the person, right? And you know, your scorn is not directed at their foolish, illogical thoughts, right? It's at the person. You're scornful, relative to the person. You see the person as lesser, not their thoughts as lesser.
That's a good distinction to keep in mind, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just find myself in my head without even saying the words, like, oh, well, that's stupid. And, like, you know,
and again, I'm not judging the person, but I must judge their thoughts.
Yeah.
See, you know, that's the problem with that judge-not-ism. It doesn't separate the person and the thoughts. It blurs them together, right? And you end up not judging their thoughts, you know, for fear of judging them as a person. It's like, no, you must judge their thoughts, right?
Yeah, yeah, helpful point. Boy, we've been on quite an adventure on our discussions this evening, but all very helpful, applied living kind of stuff.
Of the 420 counselors would counsel you the same way as this, so maybe we should transition to section four.
Beautiful, beautiful segue. I'll take it. Yeah, moving on to paper 45 of the Urantia Papers, the Local System Administration. We are in section four, the 420 counselors. It's on page 513 of the original single column text, and we're talking about those worlds up there, you know, our local system headquarters. This is about Jerusalem, our system capital. I think that's where the counselors are at. So.
Yep.
At the center of the seven angelic residential circles on Jerusalem is located the headquarters of the Urantia Advisory Council, the 420 counselors. John the Revelator called them the 420 elders, and round about the throne were 420 seats, and upon the seats I saw 420 elders sitting clothed in white raiment. The throne in the center of this group is the judgment seat of the presiding archangel, the throne of the resurrection, roll call of mercy and justice for all Satania. This judgment seat has always been on Jerusalem, but the 24 surrounding seats were placed in position no more than 1900 years ago, soon after Christ Michael was elevated to the full sovereignty of Nebadon. These 420 counselors are his personal agents on Jerusalem, and they have authority to represent the Master Sun in all matters concerning the roll calls of Satania and in many other phases of the scheme of mortal ascension on the isolated worlds of the system. They are the designated agents for executing the special requests of Gabriel and the unusual mandates of Michael.
Oh, that was a great big mouthful of a paragraph. Okay, let's just touch upon a few points here. So for those who aren't, you know, as familiar with this part of the book, we'll get into the details of the seven angelic residential circles and stuff in the next paper, in our next series. So stay tuned for that. Quickly note, you know, we often talk about what translation of the Bible the Revelators are, you know, usually playing off of. I mean, here's a very direct example where, I mean, that is word for word, you know, not a single word changed, straight out of the King James Version.
Yeah.
And easily seen, you know, that they're not using, you know, the Catholic translation of the Latin Vulgate, the Douay Rheims from back then, or the American Standard Version, right, from back then. It's the King James Version. And, you know, that's fundamentally their basis, and they modify from there. Note that. And, the word raiment, you know, certainly stands out in that regard.
Yeah. Shakespearean.
The ray part of raiment, you know, is the word array. We have another word that sort of literally means the exact same thing, you know, relative to, that arraying of things. The word attire, I mean, raiment is attire. Those are both speaking to this ordered array, right, of being enclosed, right? So, going off on a tangent there of etymology again. Raiment, should immediately get you thinking, that sounds like the King James. Yeah, but every other word is literally precisely how it is in the King James. This concept of these 420 counselors, remember from other parts of the Revelation that, as they're saying there, Michael set this up at, post-Pentecost, and, you have this set of counselors that not only oversees our planet, our rebellion sphere, but they also oversee the other 36 rebellion spheres, but not directly like they do with ours, indirectly. There are varied sizes of sets of counselors for those other 36 rebellion worlds too, and these 26 oversee them. And you can see why that is, because Michael is overseeing those 37 worlds, and he's overseeing them through them. They're his designated agents.
The thing that strikes me about this is, and maybe we'll talk about, maybe this isn't the right time to be bringing this up, but just how much power and authority, like somebody like John the Baptist, who's only, 2,000 mm-hmm. years old. That seems like a lot of power for somebody who's not very old.
Yes. Yes. So, it reinforces, as we'll mention when we get to it here in a little bit in the list. He was indicated to be a rather precocious individual from birth. You see him moving on a pace in the grand scheme of things here.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you wear really uncomfortable sweaters for God.
it's probably the asceticism that got him there so quick, yes.
Exactly.
Or his diet. Who knows?
Again, is the firmness of his conviction to righteousness, right? That's what propels you forward.
Wow, that's something right there.
And the one other note there, even they're talking about how they have such an important role relative to the whole issue of the roll calls, resurrection and such things. We obviously can't, don't have any clue about most of, what they're talking about. But, you certainly can understand that they would be in charge of the millennial and then just the, the special resurrections. Who is being resurrected in those special resurrections, whether they're millennial or not. Right? I mean, so there's a simple thing that from what they tell us in the Revelation, that you go, So they would be, they would have a lot to say about that. Right? And they talk about how there's angels that help them with a lot of these things and stuff like that as advisors. But nonetheless, right, they're kind of the point group on that issue. It's like, well, we've got a millennial resurrection here coming up. Who's going to be resurrected, and who's going to wait until the next dispensational resurrection?
But they're not doing actually any judging. They're just judging timelines. That's the ancient today's job, to judge.
Well,
right?
There's this whole, there's an elaborate, what we would call micromanagement, even, coordination of all things. Who exactly should be on the mansion worlds at this point in time relative to, the universe's circumstances at this point in time. And all these details are being considered.
Hmm.
Right? And they have a big role in those issues.
That's so interesting.
No, Chris can, we don't need him right now. He can wait until the next dispensational resurrection.
Yeah, put him on the next bus.
So those kinds of issues anyway. If people are wondering, it's like, well, specifically, what does that mean? That they represent the Master Son in all matters concerning the roll calls of Satania, right? In other phases of the scheme of mortal ascension. There's a million things we don't know about, couldn't even speculate about, but you can at least kind of get in the ballpark with that thought about the special resurrections.
These 24 counselors have been recruited from the 8 Urantia races, and the last of this group were assembled at the time of the resurrection roll call of Michael, 1900 years ago. This Urantia Advisory Council is made up of the following members.
So just quickly there, notice we're not separating out the Nodites as a separate race. So, in other words, we're probably going to be just kind of thinking of Andites, rather than necessarily specificity of Nodite, Adamite.
Right.
I think it's also interesting that they have, these different races, because there must be that super additive consequence that you have when you have, that spectrum.
Yep.
That
exactly.
Spectrum. Mm-hmm.
We're going to see that they, as we get into the list here, they're picking, a representative sort of each main human theme, as it were, right, of our history.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Gets represented directly there on the council.
Right. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Number one, Onagar, the mastermind of the pre-planetary prince age, who directed his fellows in the worship of the breath giver.
All right. So here we've got Andonite. Right? So we have pre-planetary prince Andonite, and everyone remembers Onagar is way back there from almost at the beginning. He was born 10,085 years after Andon and Fanta, so back almost at the beginning. right, of actual humans.
Wow.
You know, so the master of that, of those 500,000 years of pre-planetary prints and andonites was there at the beginning. That tells you something, right? And we all know there's lots of backmating issues that went on.
But you think that if we saw him at the Natural History Museum, he would look kind of like one of those little hairy ape guys?
No, no. I mean, again, he's not backmated. He stands very erect and, you know, is basically hairless. And he's an actual human instead of a degraded human. And of course, the, you know, the breath thing, you know, is important, just, you know, that was there from the very beginning. Yeah, we were just talking about spiritual. Well, you know, in Latin, the word spirit means breath.
Right.
Okay. And so, you know, if we want to go with the literalness of the word, we might want to try to push it forward for Monagar, because technically it's still there.
Breath. Yeah. The thing you see when you exhale when it's cold as you're being cursed by the ice. Yes.
Yes.
It's very, very visible.
Right.
Yeah. Two, Mansant, the great teacher of the post-planetary prince age on Urantia, who pointed his fellows to the veneration of the great light.
So in the wake of planetary prince, you know, so here we have andonite again. Only now, you know, it's post-planetary prince. Here's a great example of when we read the Planetary Mortal Ethics paper a while back on Symmetry of Soul. You know, I was making sure everyone recognized that they were speaking about post-planetary prince man, post-Adamic man. I mean, you literally have a different kind of man, and so that different kind of man has a different representative for the Andonites. There's two flavors of andonites.
Wow, yeah.
Before they were changed and after they were changed, right, by the dispensational change.
Right? Now, Chris, how did you reason through that he's an andonite? I wasn't able to figure this out.
The if you go and look in the you know, the paper on the colored races,
right,
the Revelation. You know, the Evolutionary Races of Color, paper 64. You're talking about all of these individuals again, like Anomalantan, et cetera, like we're going to read about. And you know, they point out that they're mentioning Mansant because and they're only mentioning those who were exemplary of their race, you know, and that in the wake of telling you the exemplary person for each of the six Sangic races, right, so you know he's,
right,
you know, he's of a race that's not one of the six.
Huh, fair right. Point.
Okay, so he's an Andonite, all right, and, yeah. Not to mention when you have it in this list like this, it's like, well, okay, the Andonites come before the, you know, the Sangic races, right? So it just makes sense. But like I said, the key is that there has to be two Andonite representatives because there's two different kinds of Andonites, pre and post.
There's been a different spiritual economy.
And you can see that new dispensation takes him, you know, much more directly to the spiritual rather than the most ethereal material breath must be spiritual, right? Now he's going, no, not breath, light.
Yeah, they go from breath to light. That's interesting.
Right. So you can see that dispensational upgrade, you know, was an actual upgrade.
So
three.
Just real quick, this Onagar and Mansant, how? Like, I wonder when they were resurrected, like, how old are they as far as being awake and not sleeping? You know, I'm just throwing that
well,
out.
Well, I mean, if Anagar wasn't resurrected before, he was resurrected when the planetary prince arrived 500,000 years ago.
Right.
Wow, boy, that'd make him an old guy.
But he might have been resurrected in a millennial or a special one before that. You don't know.
Okay. Okay, just curious.
Mansant, at the latest, would have been resurrected when Adam and Eve began their dispensation here, but also possibly before then in some other resurrection.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right.
See, Mansant is in that whole span, you know, like the other six you're going to read about, and somewhere between 500,000 years ago and, you know, and, you know, 35,000, 40,000 years ago with Adam and Eve.
Right. Okay.
Three, Anamanalantan, a far distant leader of the red man and the one who directed this race from the worship of many gods to the veneration of the Great Spirit.
You know, we could talk extensively about each of these six, but I would just refer the curious, if you go to the Perfecting Horizons Library, in the Q&A section, the questions and answers section, there's a Q&A in there that's addressing the nature of the Sanghiks relative to mind. It's called Sanghiks and Mind here in the library. And one of the example I use to help flesh out that favoritism that each Sanghik has for one of the adjutants, you know, over the other ones, is what you have here in this list. And you've got some of them there, you know, some of these god names in the evolutionary religions, evolutionary races of color paper, okay, but you got them all right here, you know, and just I flesh out, I unpack, you know, why did each of those races, you know, think of that name for God? Why is that natural for them to name God the way they did?
Oh, that'll be interesting.
And so I encourage people, if they're curious, to take a look at that, and you know, to think a little bit more about each of these individuals and what, you know, what they contribute in this spectrum of differential.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I've always.
To the extent we know
much about any of these teachers, I've always liked Anamanalantan. I mean, maybe it's because he was taking up residence on my continent of origin here. I'm just a fan.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The Redwoods, yeah.
It's very evocative. Well, his home in the tower in Redwoods, maybe it reminds me of something out of a Star Wars movie or something, Endor or something.
Well,
yeah.
And remember, he's the most recent.
He's only 65,000 years ago. The others are
and his name
farther
is so
back.
Much fun to say.
Very, very much the case. Very, very fun. Orlandoff, number four, Orlandoff, a prince of the Blue Men and their leader in the recognition of the divinity of the Supreme Chief, a prince.
Just one little thing to note here before we read the rest of them. You know, you have them in red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo order, except Orlandoff, he's pulled out, put up right after Anamanalantan. That's an interesting thing to note, and one can wonder, why is that? Why did they take him out of, you know, spectrum order, rainbow order?
Right.
You know, maybe you could speculate that you've got, you know, up front here the two, you know, long-term definitive expressions of the antipodal individuals, you know, the red man with his favoritism of unity consciousness and the blue man favoritism of individuality consciousness. But, yeah, it's, I don't, you know, I won't say for certain I know why they did that, but it's an obvious thing that they did and what that means.
Huh. So you know the answer, but you're not going to tell us?
No, I'm just saying, you know, it might be that, but that's just a speculation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Just an example of the kind of...
Keep in mind, if you have an insight at some point, maybe I know why they did that. Anyway.
Example of the way that you can reflect on the, you know, Dave, as you mentioned, you know, the precise details in the text and I will admit I have fuzzed out many, many times, including earlier today when I read this list. I'm like, what am I supposed to make of this thing? But, well, there's something I hadn't quite paid attention to before. Thank you, Chris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's see. Dave, would you care to take the reading from here?
Sure. 5. Porshunta, the oracle of the extinct orange race and the leader of this people in the worship of the great teacher.
Besides noting their god names, you know, you could notice how one is described as a prince, one is described as an oracle. All these little, you know, hints on the mentality of those races.
Yeah.
Okay, 6. Singlongten, the first of the yellow men to teach and lead his people in the worship of one truth instead of many. Thousands of years ago, the yellow man knew of the one God.
And then his material mind that favors the fifth adjutant kind of tended to fuzz out into a social consciousness rather than a religious one.
Groups, yeah, right. The one.
Seven, Fontad, the deliverer of the green men from darkness and their leader in the worship of the one source of life.
And by darkness there, we don't mean sin. We just mean lack of personality management, lack of religious nature.
Hmm. They call him a deliverer.
Yeah, it's not darkness and death, right? It's just darkness.
Like I pointed out, I mean, the simplest thing of darkness just means, you know, in contrast to light, and light means personality management. So that's the sense here. You're not saying that they were all, steeped in iniquity.
This was definitely one they get a little, well, I don't feel sorry for them. It's just they get a little short shrifted. I mean, they went extinct. They are a secondary Sangic race, and they appeared on our world, and they got incorporated into our genetic pool. But there's just not a whole lot more that you can say about them. I mean, we're not going to digress into the various races. That's a different study. But I always feel like I don't know much about them at all.
Yeah, well, just remember, you know, the primary, secondary thing is very obvious just in the first family, right? The first Sangic family. You had just, you know, a male and female pair of each of the secondaries, just two of them. Now, there were four of the blue and the yellow and five of the red, right? The primaries, you know, had two pairs, and, you know, and red even had one to spare.
Yeah.
Most likely the very first child born was a male red, and then pairs followed after that. Because the
pairs
red man
meaning
is spear
twins?
Point.
Pairs
what was
meaning
that?
Twins?
Yeah.
When you say pairs,
male, female.
You mean twins?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so just like Anna and Infante, you know, they come out male-female pairs.
Oh, wow.
It's got to be tough being that fifth wheel.
No pressure.
Yeah.
He's like Adam, since in a sense, he's that first male in the process here. Oh, we can mention that. Right? Notice how, you know, we're talking about counselors who are going to direct, and so we have direction here, not place.
The male, you mean?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we've gone over this before.
Right.
Eight, Orvontan, the enlightener of the indigo. Oh, Orvonon. Well, what did I say, Orvontan?
Yeah.
Or I didn't sleep there. The enlightener of the indigo races and their leader in the one-time service of the God of Gods.
Yeah, just, you know, the other thing about all these seven, right, including Mansan. As you have some of them before the rebellion and some of them after the rebellion. I mean, Orlandoff was, you know, just right after the rebellion, for instance.
The number 8, Orvanon, why is the name so similar to Orvanton, do you think?
I'm glad I didn't say wonton or something, you know, related to food.
Don't know.
Okay.
9, Adam, the discredited but rehabilitated planetary father of Urantia, a material son of God who was relegated to the likeness of mortal flesh, but who survived and subsequently elevated to this position by the decree of Michael.
So he goes from a being that doesn't have a soul, right, you know, or an adjuster, right, to one that does, and so, you know, he becomes, you know, effectively humanized, right, by that default and the consequences, and now he can be part of this group.
Yeah. I mean, his identity underwent a lot of transformation, but he was still the same personality throughout all of it.
Right. Keep that in mind. You know that fundamentally we're talking about effectively for most of these Marantia selves who need a Marantia brain. But material sons and daughters, in general, don't have souls.
Right.
Angels don't have souls.
And how old would they? How old would this pair be, Adam and Eve? How old would they be?
Yeah, well, we don't know. They could have been around for a very, very, very long time before they were sent down to our planet to be an Adam and Eve.
And you just can't help but root for Adam and Eve, too. Like, you just, I just feel like I always want to champion him on. I feel bad. Like, I think when I first read the Urantia book, I had this, like, disgruntled opinion about them. But, like, after longer and realizing how much I'm, messing things up, I really developed, like, an affinity and wanting to champion for Adam.
And remember, like we pointed out, the only reason that they could be here, that they could be rehabilitated, is because they sincerely repented.
Yeah.
They hadn't, that would have been the end of them.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I thought the sincere repentance was because of sin. And they hadn't reached rebellion because they hadn't sin. Maybe I've held on to that incorrectly.
If they hadn't sincerely repented, they wouldn't have gotten an adjuster, and they wouldn't have had a soul, and they wouldn't have survived.
Well, that's helpful. 10, Eve, the mother of the violet race of Urantia, who suffered the penalty of default with her mate, and was also rehabilitated with him and assigned to serve with this group of mortal survivors.
Yeah, so in this case, she is, she's no longer, manifesting place. And she is manifesting direction in the sense that we will call them material sons in general, or call us as ourselves faith sons or ascending sons, or she's not birthing babies and nurturing them with maternal instinct here on the on the 420 counselors.
But if they had lived out their role as the Adam and Eve, the same trajectory would have eventually happened to them, right?
Yep. Okay. Yep. In the same way that you go through menopause, right, and eventually leave that role behind.
Yeah.
So do material daughters.
Do they still keep that title, material son and daughter, even though now they're completely differently orientated?
What is the first thing you said?
Oh, do they still keep that title, material sons even though now they're you know, completely differently orientated?
There's, you know, we'll talk about that with Melchizedek here too in a second. I mean, there's probably some sort of indication, but just for simplicity, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But yes, they are modified material sons and daughters. Yes. Yeah. I mean, they're effectively ascending sons of God now.
It's interesting how they say that she was also rehabilitated with him, almost indicating that Adam was the one who needed to do that wholehearted repentance, and she's also doing it as a consequence of being associated with him. Am I picking up wrong on that? Am I picking up some wrong feelings?
I mean, again, you know, he did it. You know, he directionized the default when he joined into it. If he hadn't joined into it, there still would have been a non-default directionality that could have led the planet forward. But see, again, it's, you know, the direction needs to be towards God, not towards self. And fundamentally, that's where they went astray. Their direction is being rehabilitated.
I know we need to move on, but are you saying that if Adam had decided, okay, I'm not going to go into this with her, he would have led the world alone without her?
Yeah. Remember, they talk about that directly in the book.
That'd be like getting raised by divorced parents, wouldn't it? Oh, wow.
I mean, you know, remember Adamson stayed? His wife and kids left.
Huh. Yep.
Yeah, those are good papers to revisit. 11, Enoch. The first of the mortals of Urantia to fuse with the thought adjuster during the mortal life in the flesh.
So literally, right, we've got, you know, someone who probably was pretty definitively Andite way, way back, right, and he was the first to fuse. Remember, there was a red man who was the first to get a personal pair of guardian seraphim, guardians of destiny.
Mm-hmm. I must have missed that. Yeah.
But the first to fuse, is he was someone here in the post, material sun age, that pushed all the way to fusion during the mortal life.
And you're reasoning that he would have been Andite and just a augmented genetics, something sufficient to allow for fusion?
Yeah, you can see, especially you read the next one. I mean, see, the point is, they've introduced Adam and Eve, direct, violet race progenitors being part of this. Right now, and then we have those that are very much,
right.
Only of that modality on the planet, post violet race being infused.
12. Moses, the emancipator of a remnant of the submerged violet race and the instigator of the revival of the worship of the Universal Father under the name of the God of Israel.
You say, well, that's really kind of narrow relative to some of these others, like the Great Light or something. Yeah, but notice we're bringing in national life as a divine ideal. That's beginning to come into play, right? By having the concept of a nation associated with God. So, all part of the process.
Yeah. 13, Elijah, a translated soul of brilliant spiritual achievement during the post-material sun age.
See how they're mentioning the violet rays, post-material sun, so that you get the sense, Brad, here, these three are three different flavors in that mode. And he has brilliant spiritual achievement, see, brilliant personality management achievement.
That's awesome.
and as I pointed out many times, right, regardless of the cultural modality so long ago, right, you know, the takeaway from the story of Elijah is faith submission to the
right.
Father's will. Right, that's the spiritual achievement. I mean, he brilliantly submitted himself by faith to the Father's will.
Mm. And it wasn't a life of material ease, any of these last three we just listed. You can read about them to some greater or lesser degrees in the Bible, and these were people who had their ups and downs, to say the least. So
again,
don't think being spiritual means you're on the path of ease. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That righteousness, that spiritual achievement, that personality management, that unnaturalness.
That's
that
so awesome.
Religiosity in contrast to humanism.
Yeah. It's impressive.
14. Macaventa Melchizedek, the only son of this order to bestow himself upon the rancher races. While still numbered as a Melchizedek, he has become forever a minister of the Most Highs, eternally assuming the assignment of service as a mortal ascender. Having sojourned on Urantia in the likeness of mortal flesh at Salem in the days of Abraham, the Melchizedek has latterly proclaimed vicegerent planetary prince of Urantia, with headquarters on Jerusalem, and authority to act in behalf of Michael, who is actually the planetary prince of the world whereon he experienced his terminal bestowal in human form. Notwithstanding this, Urantia is still supervised by successive resident governors general, members of the 24 counselors.
Yeah, and obviously Machaventa stands out distinctly.
Yeah.
He doesn't have an adjuster, right? Like even Adam and Eve do. Okay, but he does have a soul, right? Because he had an adjuster while he was incarnate here. And that's fundamentally why he can be in this list.
Oh, wow. And he put in some work when he had that adjuster, too. He got some soul built there.
That gives him the requisite bottom-upness here, that is this group. Because he's otherwise he's a very descending son, top down sort of individual, right? He's a Melchizedek. The whole quote unquote forever a minister of the Most High, they're playing off of that, use of the word, classic use of forever in the book of Hebrews. When they're talking about Jesus as a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, that's a Yeah, so that quote-unquote is a playoff of that.
Right.
This issue of, that Maranja soul, see, merged with his Melchizedek nature, which is not surprising since, his energy nature is very malleable as a Melchizedek. And so that soul is incorporated into his being. So he's not, really a Melchizedek anymore. They say, while still numbered as a Melchizedek, it's like, well, yes, but he's not. Right.
Yeah.
He's
got
so
something of experiential acquirement that he got from our world, and that, and that nothing will ever take that away from him.
Yeah, in the same way that a creator son is. Yeah, it's changed. And becomes a master son. There's creature combined with creator, and here's ascender combined with descender. The other thing is
about.
Oh, go ahead.
You got to wonder about the original, first time meet and greet with these 24. Like, imagine Machaventa Melchizedek hobnobbing with Onagard. Like, talk about two different. Beans. Wow.
Yeah, well, Melchizedek knew Onagar, before he came to, Urantia. So,
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, remember, you know, some of those that were resurrected long ago, right, have been, were held back for reasons that may not have been explained until Pentecost.
Okay, yeah.
You're not going to be ascending. Why not? Well, just, you know, hang out. We'll tell you eventually. the other thing is, you know, the fact that, you know, since the beginning of the 20th century, you know, since Machavento has been vice gerent planetary prince of Urantia, being in the 20th century, I have to remember we're in the 21st century now. you know, this whole bit about these 420 counselors, you know, being such direct agents of the Master Sun, it's even more so now since he became vice gerent planetary prince.
Yeah. Do you think at that last sentence there, they're just kind of like consoling us a little bit, because our first natural thought is to be like, well, hey, who's at the helm here? And they're like, don't worry, your aunt is still supervised by the resident governor general.
No, that's just, you know, I mean, that brings in that whole discussion of, well, when is he going to assume? And it's like, well, everything is still just rolling along as before.
All right.
Andrea, did you want to take over?
Sure. Did you have something, Brad?
No, I was just going to suggest that very thing.
Okay, great. 15, John the Baptist, the forerunner of Michael's mission on Urantia and in the flesh, cousin of the Son of Man.
Yeah, and, you know, as I was hinting before, we talked about a lot when we were reading about John the Baptist, you know, a while back on this broadcast. I mean, you know, you very much see him, you know, embodying what, as Jesus said, how he's the greatest of all the prophets. Right? We, you know, we had that one classic prophet of Elijah being represented. You know, he's exemplary in that he fused. But John the Baptist is exemplary because he's the greatest.
Yeah, I was actually just rereading paper 135, John the Baptist, today for a different study, and I was impressed by how in some ways he was an embodiment of a great many of the best of all the prophets that came before. He studied diligently. He regarded the past prophets highly. Like he sort of was the culmination of that age of the successive prophets. I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
And then another oddball.
16, 1, 2, 3, the first, the leader of the loyal midway creatures in the service of Gabriel at the time of the Caligastia betrayal, elevated to this position by Michael soon after his entrance upon unconditioned.
Yeah, so, you know, he's, again, you can see that they're all in different ways you know, ascending sons. And so we have this additional flavor added. You know, it's interesting that it's a primary midwayer, right? Not a secondary.
Yeah.
So it makes it, you know, even more of a differential, right, to add to the group.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
and you're left kind of just speculating about exactly why, okay? But, you know, Michael obviously has his reasons.
Yeah, how they round each other out, so to speak. Okay. These selected person. Wait, let's see, did I read this? Yeah.
I mean, maybe just, before you read that next paragraph, I mean, just quickly, I mean, the fact that they have to oversee not only our, you know, rebellion world, but the other 36, right, there's midwayers on all those worlds, so you know him being on this amongst the 24, you know, adds that perspective to their oversight of these of the rebel worlds.
That's a helpful point. Yeah,
these selected personalities are exempt from the ascension regime for the time being, on Gabriel's request, and we have no idea how long they may serve in this capacity.
So like we were joking about, you know, Onagar long ago, Gabriel said, no, he's exempt from the ascension regime. Well, why is that?
Seats number 17, 18, 19, and 20 are not permanently occupied. They are temporarily filled by the unanimous consent of the 16 permanent members being kept open for later assignment to ascending mortals from the present post-bestowal sun age on Urantia.
So the one thought here, you know, when they mentioned about their successive resident governors general, okay, you know, let's say that sometime in the not-too-distant future, Machaventa assumes full planetary prince, and so you won't have these counselors rotating through as resident governors general anymore. Okay, but, you know, obviously, all appearances that you're going to continue to have the 4 and 20. Right? And
yeah.
Eventually you're going to get a magisterial son sometime in the not-too-distant future, you know, possibly. Right? And you'll probably set up four more permanents then, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, from this post-soul sun age.
Right. Numbers 21.
I'm hoping it's Thomas Aquinas is in there. That's just my personal money on Aquinas.
You're not allowed to vote, Brad, okay?
All right.
Well, it definitely won't be Bertrand Russell.
Right.
No.
I was thinking maybe Lincoln. I've always thought maybe Lincoln. I've always speculated Lincoln made the list.
Because, yeah, he had brilliant intellectual achievement, but not brilliant spiritual achievement.
Okay, right. Numbers 21, 22, 23, and 24 are likewise temporarily filled while being held in reserve for the great teachers of other and subsequent ages, which undoubtedly will follow the present age. Eras of the magisterial sons and teacher sons and the ages of light and life are to be anticipated on your rancher, regardless of unexpected visitations of divine sons, which may or may not occur. Oh, that's a teaser at the end.
Woo-hoo. Yeah. So, right, I mean, just the first part, see, so, you know, it's all set up, you know, where, you know, Michael maybe is going to have this, you know, going on for a very, very, very long time, you know, way into light and life even, right?
Yeah.
You know, so these guys could be on ascension hold for a long time, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. You know, and then that last one, and she's another example of how I often point out, right, there could be one of the unrevealed sons, you know, even unrevealed paradise sons that could come.
Mm.
That's what they're hinting at the end there.
And fill one of these seats?
No. Just, you know.
Come to our world.
You know, you have the normal dispensations, but those could be, you know, even further complicated on our world by having some son that normally doesn't come to any world come to our world.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's a fascinating governance system that got set up for... I always have to remind myself, not just our world, certainly especially our world, but 36 other worlds, but staffed by people from our world with maybe one exception. It's just that there's a lot to think about in there. It certainly clears up the Book of Revelation. It's not as spooky anymore. It's a set of counselors. We'll leave it there. Glad to be back with you here this Tuesday evening. Hope to see you again next Tuesday. Follow the way.
God bless everybody. Have a great week.
Yes. Thank you, Dave, and yeah, thank you, Andrea, and we'll get to section 5 next week. We thought we were going to get there, but we had lots to talk about. So tune in next week, and peace be upon you.